Starting to see some faces that I recognize. Hope you're all nice and cool wherever you are. And that maybe you were able to find one of those above ground pools that everybody's looking for in my neighborhood. Okay, so I think we're settled. This is Emily Cooper. I am the Chief Housing Officer at the Executive Office of Elder Affairs. Thank you for joining us again this week. For those of you who this is your first call, this is part of a partnership between Elder Affairs and a handful of state housing agencies to communicate with and support senior affordable housing housing providers. We recognized early on that you all are on the front lines and we didn't really have a mechanism to talking with you or hearing from you. So we set up these calls as a way to do that and to hopefully spread information about topics of interest to you. Before we get started, I want to thank Leading Age Massachusetts for hosting these calls, for providing technology support. And with that, I'm going to turn it to Lynn to just do a Zoom 101, which I know you're all experts on by now.
Good afternoon, everybody. Just a couple of quick items regarding the functionality of Zoom that we're going to use in today's call. So everyone who, the default for everyone coming into the meeting is to be muted. So if you would like to make a comment or ask a question, if you're on your computer, you'll want to click the microphone icon to unmute yourself, typically found in the bottom left-hand toolbar. If you are on the phone and would like to unmute, you will need to press star 6. In either case, we would ask that once you've made your question or comment that you do re-mute yourself, and you do that the same way that you unmute yourself, either by clicking the icon on your computer or by pressing star 6 on your phone. We will also be using the chat box function. So for those of you on a computer, you'll see the little chat icon in that toolbar. If you click on that, a box will come up where you can put your questions or comments throughout the call. We have multiple individuals on this call who will be monitoring that, and we'll make sure the questions get answered. For those of you who are on the phone and don't have access to the chat box, you're welcome to send me an email with your question or comment. My email address is lmonaghan@leadingagema.org.
Thanks, Lynn. Hopefully you guys are pros at this. I already see people using the chat function. So before we get started, I just want to recognize that this is a partnership between Elder Affairs, Department of Housing and Community Development, Mass Housing, and CDAC. And I just want to give a few of those folks a moment to say hello. Amy Stitely from DHCD, I see you there.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Leading Age, for hosting us. And thank you to all the providers for continuing to keep people safe. We are seeing trends in the right direction for the Commonwealth, and we really appreciate all the work you're doing.
Thanks, Amy. And Sarah Barkin from CDAC.
Thank you, Emily. Again, just want to welcome everybody to the call. These have been incredibly informative, certainly for me, and I know for all of you in recent months. And we recognize that it's hard to take the time for, you know, these sort of continued coming together around all of these different topics. And we really appreciate that you're all doing that. And we hope we can continue to provide a valuable service to you and your colleagues.
Thanks, Sarah. And Mass Housing isn't available right now, but they're also part of the partnership. And HUD is often invited to be on the call as well. So this really is an interagency group. I want to encourage you all, if you have any questions or experiences you want to share or want to tell us about what's going on with you, to use our dedicated email address, seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. That's also how you can sign up for our listserv, which is over 400 people at this point. We find all sorts of resources and send them out to you. And we also, hopefully, if you have submitted questions through that email, we have been able to respond, even if we say we don't know the answer or we have somebody get back to you. So last thing is that we do these weekly calls. And if this is your first one or you missed a few, they are recorded and they can be found online on Leading Age's website. And my minions are great. I see them already putting all these things in the chat room. But if you don't have access to the chat room, you can email seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov and we will get all those resources. So enough from me. I want to introduce our two speakers that we have today who are really experts in their field. We asked them to talk about how to keep older adults safe, particularly with regards to protective services. This is an area that the Elder Affairs is both required by law to be involved in, but also is very passionate about. And regardless of the pandemic, this is an area that we spend a fair amount of time about how to make sure that elders are not at harm to themselves, people are not harming them, whether it's neglect, whether it's abuse, what it may be. So we're gonna use this opportunity to not only remind you how the protective service system works here in Massachusetts and to hear from the state on how that is set up, but to also hear from one of the protective services local agencies about how their operations work, and then also what we've seen in COVID, any trends, any changes, what we're anticipating happening, and how you all who are actually in the housing or working with the residents or hearing from them, how you can be helpful in and how you can utilize protective services to help people that live in your housing. So without further ado, I'm gonna turn it over to Jonathan Fielding, who's a protective officer at the Executive Office of Elder Affairs. And Jonathan, if you wanna go ahead and unmute yourself. Perfect. And I'm gonna be quiet.
Okay. And up there's the training. I wanted to cover just some basics before we really move into how protective services has changed over the last couple of months. But just some reminders on reporting what the program process is. This is a brief PowerPoint slide deck that will be sent out to you as well. There's nothing earth-shattering in it. And again, my guess is that most of you already know this. Next slide. There it goes. Technically, there are four steps, assuming an intake gets screened in. The first is the intake gets filed either via our central intake unit or hotline, or you can do the intake on our web portal. It next goes to the agencies. You'll hear from Old Colony as one of those protective agencies, but once the intake is taken, it gets dumped automatically into the right agency screening queue. They're responsible for deciding does it move on to an investigation or not. If it does move on to an investigation, they're the ones that then do the investigation. 30 days generally to do an investigation. And for those cases that they actually substantiate, they'll move those into ongoing services and keep them into ongoing services depending on the case dynamics. It could be a very quick in and out. Could be that they're involved for a year, year and a half. Unfortunately, because of some of the COVID stuff that we've seen in the last several months, some of these protective cases have kind of gotten put almost on a stall or standby, you know, with the courts, you know, taking a lot longer to hear cases. They're possibly not getting in. They're just continuing a guardianship and they're not getting in to make it permanent. The protective services is staying in longer. So you may see some changes in particular with investigations and ongoing services. I do know there were some questions related to home visits during COVID. And I will talk about that briefly. Next slide. Our number has not changed. I've been in the program for about 29 years, both the local level and at Elder Affairs. That number has not changed in 30 years. Call 1-800-922-2275. It's a fully functioning hotline that operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, you know, at any point in time, you can really call. Depending on the time of day, they're going to have different staffing levels. And I know somebody's going to ask the question, yes, the hotline is working remotely just like everybody else's, but they have the capability of having the same setup and features that they would if they were in the office. So you should not notice any differences with them operating remotely. They are there, like I said, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to take a report. I will add, if there are concerns, about the hotline, you can raise those with your local agencies, or you can escalate those to Elder Affairs. I'm the regional manager currently that oversees the hotline, so I do want to hear if there are any concerns or issues. Next slide. This is sometimes scary to people in terms of the information that we want in a report, but if you think about a report, it's not only to make sure we have enough information to decide what Protective Services is going to do if they go out, it's also to decide if they're going to go out. And when you provide less than adequate information, you know, an agency like Old Colony doesn't know what to do with it. And either they're sending somebody out and it puts the elder or the worker at risk, or they're deciding there's not enough to investigate and they'll screen it out. So the more information you can provide, specifically examples, and not just names and addresses, but examples, what's going on, what do you see the level of risk to be, medications if you know those. You know, it's very frustrating for Protective if they can't communicate with somebody when they go out or when they call on the phone. You know, so any information that you have related to that. Because the other thing they're having to decide is how quickly they need to go out. You know, is it something within 5 hours they need to respond to, or is it something they can take up to 5 days to go out for a visit? So again, depending on the information you provide, it can sway them in one direction or another. Next slide. If you don't want to call the hotline, if for the reason you've had a bad experience, you know, certainly I would like to fix that if possible. But we do have a reporting feature that you can go to this website and report online. Next slide. Ideally, you won't have problems with this. I will say that the form that's in here is not something that's through Elder Affairs. It's through the company that also does the APS or the database that we use to track cases. So, you know, if there's some sort of problem, again, we want to try and help you work through it. You would click on Report Elder Abuse. Next slide. And then File an Elder Abuse Report. And is that the last slide or did I put one more in? I don't remember. Okay, if you can go back then. Once you click on that, it will bring up the actual form. It's an expandable form. There are fields that you're going to see starred in red that are mandatory that you fill out. If you don't fill out the required fields, it will not let you complete and submit the form. Sometimes people are a little ingenious in terms of how they get around certain required information. I don't recommend you do that if you can avoid it. But certainly, you fill out the form, you put in your narrative. You type your narrative, you put in the names, addresses. It allows you to expand areas, shrink areas, depending on what you need and don't need. I do want to caution you with the web portal is there is a timeout feature that sometimes reporters lose the heart or learn the hard way. Usually it's a fire department where they get called out on a call or police who are running out. They like the web portal so they can do this online as opposed to talking to somebody and taking the time on the phone, or they can attach their police report and that ends up being our protective report. The problem with the timeout feature is that an hour, I believe it is, of inactivity, it times you out and you lose everything. The form does not have a save feature. So when you're in there doing it, get all the information in and then submit it. You will get notified that you successfully submitted the form. Please don't get mouse happy and click multiple times on the mouse, because what it ends up doing is it ends up generating multiple reports that we then have to go in and delete. So certainly there are kind of tips and ideas in terms of filing a report. If you want to let us know, we can certainly help you through that process. Go back to the pictures, which I don't like. One of the hardest things, and again, I've been in this program close to 30 years, I think we would all say that we've never faced something like COVID, where we've really had to take a look at our program. But I think for us in Protective Services and for the local agencies, it's really helped us take a better look at our program, what's working, what's not working, where do we need to make changes, even without COVID, where do we need to make changes, but certainly moving forward. We started back in February with the suspicion that something was going to kind of get worse and we were going to be in a situation where everybody was working remotely. And one of the biggest things that we wanted to deal with initially was that home visit or elder interview piece. Our regulations are very, very clear that the workers are to conduct a home visit or an in-person face-to-face interview. But the problem is with COVID and with all the guidelines that we've had thrown out, that we can't do that in certain cases. We can't do that in a lot of cases. Not only because we might put an elder at risk, but we might put our workers or our staff at risk. And so what we had to do was really craft something. Protective services, as is home care, were identified as essential functions. You can't, the intakes don't stop coming in. They've decreased, but they don't stop coming in. Home care, you don't say, sorry, we're not gonna provide services. We'll see you in several months. Those are essential programs for the elders in the community. And because of that, we had to find a way to really work and craft something where home visits were still allowed and required on some level in certain situations. We're not running out, or I shouldn't say me, I'm sitting home all day. But the agencies aren't running out on a regular basis to do home visits. But there are certain things if an elder doesn't have a phone, which I know is one of the questions. If they don't have a phone and you can't interview them over the phone, or there's significant dementia, or there's a language barrier and they can't do it by phone, there are certain situations where you have no other alternatives but to do that visit. And we drew up guidelines that really walked the agencies through that, where, you know, we gave them permission to do elder interviews over the phone, provided you can do the interview over the phone. The problem is when you can't, as I said, or if you're going to put the elder at greater risk. For a domestic violence situation, are we going to tip off the person who's abusing them and create kind of a worse problem, especially for the worker going out and seeing, or for the elder who's living in the situation? And so we've tried to craft that. Home visits over the last couple of months have dramatically been reduced. There's no question about that, but they had to be reduced, both for elder safety, as I said, as well as worker safety. But at the same time, the agencies are still required to get the information. And so that's kind of the balance that we've had to find. Whereas, you know, if we're not going to get what we need by an interview, can somebody else go into the home? So if there's a concern about hoarding, you know, can somebody take a, you know, picture? Can we see something on FaceTime? As workers, if you can't interview somebody else and get the information, is there a way that you can creatively see the home environment? You know, even if it's for a couple of minutes that you're in the home and do the rest of the interview outside, get creative. We've had agencies doing elder interviews by Skype, FaceTime. They were trying Zoom, although I don't think the Zoom worked real well for them. But I know agencies have really looked at this and said, what other ways can we get the information that we need and move forward? We're actually now at the point with the Commonwealth moving towards reopening. Those are discussions that we're starting to have. You know, do we do only announced visits? Are they unannounced? How do we work through that? Again, how do we go out while still maintaining safety for the elder, but also for the workers who may be going out? Before I turn it over to Terry to kind of talk about some of the things that they faced, I know there were some questions that came through in the chat. You know, one of them was, I know going back to reporting, can anybody file? And certainly anybody can file. They're mandated reporters, people who are required by law to report that the state can go after if they don't report. Housing managers, landlords, you would all be non-mandated reporters, but that doesn't mean you can't report. And I encourage anybody who has a concern about an elder to pick up the phone. One of my biggest pet peeves is when I see something in the newspaper or in the media that could have potentially been prevented because somebody didn't pick up the phone. The other thing I will caution you is that oftentimes many people know about an abusive situation. There are multiple first responders, and maybe you as housing also know the situation. Don't assume somebody else is going to get it reported and that's going to cover you, because oftentimes what we find is everybody is pointing to the next person saying, oh, they'll do it. And the reports never get filed. And each reporter presents kind of a different perspective on what may be going on. And again, that's part of protective investigation, is to really kind of fit the puzzle pieces together. So I would encourage anybody to report. Yes, anybody can report in Massachusetts. You can file anonymously if you really want to, or if you're concerned, but the reporter's information is kept confidential. We protect that, you know, through the life of the case.
So Jonathan, I see a bunch of questions coming in, but I think what I'd like to do, you one question, we'll go to Terry, and then we'll do all of them. So the one question I have for you, Jonathan, is can I submit multiple reports? You know,
yes.
Okay.
Yep, it's you know, I think one of the most frustrating things for community professionals is I reported it and Protective didn't do anything. Why should I report again? There are a lot of reasons why Protective may not have been able to do anything. While Protective Services has to carry through with the investigation, whether the elder wants that or not, Protective Services cannot force assistance on a competent elder. Just as I can't stop you from smoking if you smoke, or from not wearing your seatbelt in the car, as competent adults, we have the right to make bad decisions. It doesn't sit well, but that's what we have to do and follow, and so we have to walk away from those situations if we can't help the elder. So something may get reported multiple times because of that, or because we couldn't find that key piece that tips it over into a substantiation as opposed to us walking away. So again, I would continue to report. The other thing I recommend that you do is you set up those relationships with your local agencies. You're not gonna be reporting to me. We're not gonna have that kind of ongoing relationship. But for somebody like Terry at Old Colony, when you have those ongoing dialogues, it's gonna help you craft your reports that much better. So, you know, report it, you know, multiple times if you need to.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Does that answer your question?
That was perfect. And so now we're gonna turn to Terry Courts. Terry's at Old Colony Elder Services, which is one of 20, I think, protective service agencies.
As of the end of the month, it'll be down to 18, I think.
Okay, 18 protective service agencies across the state. Old Colony works in the sort of Brockton area. Terry is the protective services director there. And she's gonna talk about how things have changed, how things run there, and then how things have changed. And Terry, one of the questions that came in that I'm hoping you can address is, Jonathan, mentioned it, how are you substantiating the investigations without doing a home visit, or how are you being creative when you have these reports that come in?
Okay, thank you. Yes, I'm the Protective Service Director at Old Colony Elder Services. I also have the housing programs under me, so it's kind of unique in terms of being able to be available for consultation when things come up in terms of that. So I can start with first answering that first question before I dive into some of the agenda. We are able to substantiate based on all the information that we would gather in a regular investigation. A lot of the times the information is coming via phone for the elder to gather that interview. We're still maintaining the expectations of an investigation by contacting key collaterals in our investigation process in terms of social workers, nurses, doctors, family members, anybody else, we're still communicating regarding the allegations and able to gather that information to have enough to substantiate those cases. Okay, just a couple things I wanted to add in terms of what we cover. We cover physical, emotional neglect, self-neglect, sexual abuse, and financial exploitation in terms of our investigation process. A person has to be 60 or over and reside primarily in the community, and that's what we cover for the protective service piece. If we get reports that are not ours for jurisdictional reasons, we will forward those to the appropriate agencies. Okay, for the COVID-19 stuff, it has been a challenge for us to kind of change our processes. Our workflow has remained the same. The expectations of the workflow in terms of the intakes, moving to investigations, to the screening process, and then to the service planning mode, all of those things have remained the same. We just have had to figure out how we're gonna get the workflow done in terms of that working remotely. So our agency has been pretty creative and adaptable in terms of trying to get things electronically done. We do have some small members of staff still going into the office to do some of the workflow in terms of letters to follow-up reporters, to, you know, get the mail. We're scanning in the mail and then emailing it secure to the departments. We are still maintaining getting faxes. We're referring to the district attorney's office via secure email now. So those are some of the things that we had to adapt the processes to, you know, locally, which has been, you know, phenomenal in terms of how the technology has worked in terms of that. We're still obtaining, again, documents for the cases, medical documents and financial documents when we're able to. That has been a challenge with things that have been closed. But we still are able to get those electronically as part of our investigation. In terms of seeing consumers in the nursing facilities, as people are aware, nursing facilities had, you know, limited visitation as well as some of the housings. So those situations were taken case-by-case basis to determine what's the risk to the consumer for us to visit. Does the consumer want us to visit? Are we able to visit? So we're taking each of those cases individually and looking at them to determine what's the best way to handle this case. You know, that has been a change. A lot of our workers, you know, would take an intake and run into the field and go see a consumer. And we've had to stop with that particular process and say, you need to really digest the intake. You need to look at the screening questions for yourself and for the consumer in terms of the risk with the COVID-19 in their specific situation. So it's just a different, you know, way of making sure that we're still able to get as much information as possible when we're doing an investigation. We've had to change some of the process in terms of completing what we're calling our IDA, which is our individual decisional ability tool. We were trained to do that face-to-face, and then we had to adapt that training for phone. And the workers and the supervisors at Old Colony are reporting that that is going well, and there doesn't seem to be any major issues regarding that. For record requests, we're still maintaining getting subpoenas in the mail for certain records. So we've had to really look at that as a workflow. I used to sit by the copy machine and have to copy endless pages and mark out with a Sharpie at the office, and really had to adapt the flow of that to how can I black out now in Adobe as a PDF to be able to send a record electronically per a subpoena, because that process hasn't stopped. So that was a learning curve for us as well. With the court involvement, a lot of the court involvement has been done Zoom. Our attorney has met with our workers and had that type of, you know, case conference regarding extensions in terms of court orders and restraining orders and so forth, because of the court, you know, situations. The well-being checks that the police early on, some of the police departments, it was a challenge because some of them didn't want to go into the home. And I think that that has started to change, and that has started to open up a little bit more in terms of police going in with PPE and so forth. So that was an original challenge when we first started this whole thing. Services implementation for our consumers, we rely heavily on home care and other programs in terms of going into the home to help alleviate these abusive situations. And some of the consumers have said, no, I don't want anybody in the home because I'm concerned about the risk to COVID. So they haven't wanted the services, and we've tried to reach out to them on a continuous basis, you know, with the phone to make sure that they're doing okay. The Adelta Health, again, those centers had closed, and a lot of that stuff shifted to phone contact on a more regular basis to check in with the consumers and the caregivers, because it has created a lot more strain on the caregiver role for people being at the home and being around each other 24/7. So our numbers have decreased a little bit during this time in terms of intakes, and we anticipate that that's going to change as things start to open back up, because you're going to have more, you know, face-to-face encounters, mandated reporters and so forth, you know, viewing the situations, and more elders, you know, maybe allowing people to come to the home.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt one second. Allison put one of your sheets in the chat room about scams and things that you provided. Can you guys speak to a little bit about how to protect, or what, you know, what you're seeing with regards to scams against older adults right now?
Terry, do you want that one, or you want me to?
You can start and I'll jump in. How's that?
Sounds good. I've been working financial cases probably for close to the 30 years I've been in protective services. You know, financial exploitation by a son or a daughter is difficult. But those scams, they are very, very difficult to handle from a protective services perspective because they're constantly changing what they do, what they say. They're very good at manipulating. It's their full-time job. They're very good at playing the actor or actress role and getting somebody to buy into this, you know, weird story. That said, we're all susceptible to scams, and I don't want anybody to leave this call and think, it's not going to happen to me. Age has nothing to do with it in most of these cases. It's how susceptible you are, how vulnerable you are. And so now with COVID, you know, you'll see people who are calling and I have the magic cure. I have masks that are, you know, 50 cents each. You know, you can buy them in bulk. And so everybody is looking at kind of the COVID. The scams, though, have been around for a long time. The lottery sweepstakes scam, even though silent right now, is one that's going to come back. We're seeing, at least in the intakes that I'm reading, I'm seeing a lot of the sweetheart scams, you know, where elders are taking out hundreds of thousands of dollars and trying to send it abroad to build a house with this person they met online. You know, those are the ones that scare me more than anything else. You know, the scams of old, like the pigeon drop and things like that, aren't around anymore. What the scam artists are doing now, and I think what you and housing should help people understand is, don't worry about the story. Don't worry about, is this a scam or not? Worry about the potential indicators and whether somebody could be vulnerable. Indicators are, is if somebody's asking for cash as opposed to paying by check or anything else that could be tracked, that is a problem to be looked into. Not all the time, but you can't track cash. If they're being asked to buy gift cards, I bought my daughter some Kohl's gift cards at CVS and had to go and sign all these forms. Are you aware of scams, et cetera? You know, they're using the gift cards. They're telling elders to buy them and read them the numbers over the phone, and they can wipe the gift cards electronically. There's a lot of getting into people's accounts, hacking in the computer, a lot of phishing going on. So for people who aren't familiar with the various computer sites, you know, that's a good indicator. But I'm always concerned when they get the letters and they're asked to send money. In some form or another, it's a scam. It's not a deal that you've just come across, nobody else has. It's a scam. And, you know, when elders are isolated, when they don't have the individuals to talk to, and we're all looking for some extra pocket change, you know, this sounds wonderful. And it's very easy, as I said, for any of us to fall in. But,
Terry? Well, I just want to reference that we did put in the chat room, and we'll send out afterwards, two helpful documents. One is just like a tip sheet, and that you all should feel free to share with your residents, you know, as related to scams.
Correct. And banks are not mandated reporters. Financial entities are not mandated reporters in Massachusetts. Some states they are, not in Massachusetts. But I can tell you Bank of America in particular reports a ton of elder concerns. So I'll give them credit. I know they kind of get a bad reputation sometimes for other things, but they are great in working with our protective services program. So I do have to commend them for that. But, you know, you don't have to prove anything. And I think there was a question that came in at some point in time. Well, kind of where is that? You don't have to prove anything. All you have to have is a suspicion. You have a concern about an elder. You file the report. Let our local agencies make the decision about whether it's going to go to an investigation, whether it goes to DPH because it's a nursing home. I don't want anybody other than our local agencies making those jurisdiction questions, including our hotline. They are not to make jurisdiction questions or decisions. They're to take the information and forward it to the next person.
But Jonathan, actually, that's a good point. And then Terry, we'll go back to you. There are a lot of things in the chat room that say, is this abuse? Is that abuse? Should I report if it's this? Should I report if it's that? And what I'm hearing you say is report. Don't make the decision yourself. If something's nagging you, if something feels weird, if you're suspicious, whatever it is, even if you're wrong or and whatever, make the report. Is it an anonymous report? I mean, will the person you're reporting on find out you reported on them?
No. Well, people can guess. You know, certainly you can guess all you want. Protective Services cannot confirm or deny who the reporter is. And if the record is released, the reporter's identity is protected. Even if there's a subpoena, the reporter's identity is protected. The only time the reporter's name is released is if it goes to the DA for prosecution or possible prosecution. Or if I have a worker sitting in court who is being threatened by the judge, they're going to be thrown in jail for contempt of court if they don't. But we tell them, don't give that out. Go into chambers and try and give it in private as opposed to open court. So, you know, I can't ever give 100% guarantee. In terms of reporting versus trying to get more information, my concern is there are so many different variations on a theme. You know, is it neglect? Is it self-neglect? What has to exist? You know, and Terry can tell you, and I can think of several situations, you know, over the last couple of years, it was not Protective Services jurisdiction. We made Terry's program take the reports, screen them in, and handle them from a service provision perspective because there was nobody else to do that. They were going to fall through the cracks. And so, you know, let us make that decision. We don't want those in the community making that decision.
Great. So Terry, you mentioned collateral contacts, or mm-hmm. key collateral contacts. Is housing, would they be considered a collateral contact? Is that, do you reach out to the housing folks ever?
Yes, I mean, it depends on the case. You know, and just to reiterate, if anybody's ever concerned and not sure, we're available to consult. We say that all the time, consult, consult, consult. You know, again, like you said, if something's nagging you, we want to hear about it because we want to be able to assist. For key collateral contacts, anybody that we contact, we have to go through what's called the balancing test and determine, you know, what information can we release, if any, you know, or are we just going to be gathering information from that collateral contact? We can listen to, you know, what the concerns are, but we are very cautious about what information we can give out, which is frustrating for people, but it is a requirement that the information is protected. You know, so we are calling key collaterals, like I mentioned, primary care doctors, medical people, if it's a neglect case, if there's question of capacity. But yes, housing would be key because they are aware of the situation in terms of the elder's residence, what's going on in their apartment, how are they functioning on a day-to-day basis. So yes, they would be considered key collaterals. We would just have to be cautious about what information we may be able to share with them.
And it seems like some people have asked, and you mentioned this, Jonathan, but Terry, maybe you can also, if you have an example or something, that you can't compel somebody to do something just because you think they should, right? If they're competent and they're choosing to not behave in a certain way or to behave in a certain way or not to get services or to get services. If they're competent, they get to do that. Even if you think it's, even if the world thinks it's a bad decision, even if they might lose their housing, you know, things like that.
I mean, it depends on their understanding of the situation. So yes, when we can do the investigation and we're required to do the investigation, regardless if they want to participate or not. But when it comes to that service provision piece where we say, we think that you should accept these services to help alleviate your situation, they can say, no, I don't want those services. And if they have capacity to understand those consequences, they can say, no, I'm going to choose to continue my life without those services. And if that puts me at risk, so be it, which is a frustrating piece. But we all have that right. We all have the right to say, no, I don't want to do that.
And what if they're hoarding, for example, and they're what if they've gotten an eviction notice saying, you know, you can't stay here?
It comes down to their understanding of the risk and consequences. I mean, in situations like that, we have had people who have had mental health issues or questions of their capacity, and we would go forward with some type of evaluation in dealing with the medical professionals to determine, do they really understand that they're going to be homeless? You know, do we need to do something more restrictive in this case to determine their capacity to understand with an evaluation? Do we need to go into court because their housing is at risk and they have the risk of being homeless and we don't think they understand? So it's a case by case, but we have been to court on those cases where someone's about to lose their housing and they really don't understand. And they've had to get a substitute decision maker appointed on their behalf in order to maintain that housing.
You mentioned that your case numbers have gone down during the pandemic and that you anticipate mm-hmm. them going up when things open up again.
Yep.
You know, this is one of those fields where we don't want things, I don't know if reported numbers going up reflects that things that weren't being reported before, so it's a good thing it's going up, or reflects that there's a, you know, more abuse going on. So I guess we'll have to see what happens in the future, but it's hard to predict at this point.
Yes.
So there's a question, can Protective Services mandate getting a psychiatric evaluation completed for an elder? Let's just leave that there for a second. Can you, like you mentioned, if somebody mm-hmm. is, you know, you're worried that they're not competent to understand mm-hmm. the decision, what happens in that process?
We try and utilize the professionals that are involved to stay least restrictive. So in that case, it might be communicating with a primary care physician first. In those cases, some of our elders don't see a primary care physician. So we contract with a doctor that we have available to do some of those home visits and those evaluations face-to-face, if possible. If a consumer won't participate in such an evaluation and the risk is high, we may have to go to court and get a court order that says allowing us to do an evaluation of that nature. If a person is in a hospital or a nursing facility, we would most likely be asking those professionals to assist us with that type of evaluation.
So that's come in a few times in the chat room too. Jonathan, you mentioned PS is mostly in the community, dealing with people in community, but I've also heard you say nursing facilities. There's a question in the chat room about a skilled nursing facility. What about assisted living? So where does PS, how do you interact with people in those settings?
For nursing homes, if there's an allegation of abuse by staff, that's certainly not where Protective Services would weigh in. That would be public health. That would be the ombudsman program. Assisted living, you know, again, abuse by staff usually is for certification or the ombudsman. The problem is we don't always know who those staff are. Are they somebody privately paid, you know, by the elder's family, which might make it protective. So again, each situation is going to be a little bit different. Generally, though, from a nursing home perspective, Protective Services will go in and interview elders. They will try and get information. If it's somebody that's going to be coming back into the community, if that's elder's long-term place and the concerns are, I don't want to be here, I'm, you know, being abused or neglected by staff, that would certainly go to public health. We have to decide, you know, is there a role for Protective Services? Assisted livings are very, very different than nursing homes. Assisted living are, you know, housing, you know, just higher rent. And so, you know, if it's resident to resident in a nursing home, that's not Protective Services, that is public health. If it's resident to resident in an assisted living, I'm one of those, and Terry will tell you, you know, this is the case, I make Protective take those because we don't know if it's two strangers who lived in the building for 10 years and just never known each other, or if they sit at the same table for meals, they've chatted in the hallway at times, and therefore abuse between the two of them would make it Protective Services. So again, you know, my concern is if you have concerns about an elder in a nursing home or an assisted living, and you're not sure if it would go to DPH for the nursing home, file it with our hotline, and then screeners that work with Terry or any of the other agencies will carve it out if it needs to go someplace else. And those are the ones that we talk about internally as well with the assisted living ombudsman and certification.
So to put words in your mouth again, Jonathan, what I'm hearing you say is folks on the phone, don't make these decisions yourself. Don't try to figure out, should I call DPH? Should I call Elder Affairs? Don't worry about it. Call the hotline and Elder Affairs will figure out where it should go to the right
person. Correct. Okay. I mean, the hotline will ask, we allow them to ask two kind of general screening questions. One is the individual or the consumer over 60? Because if they're under 60, it's not our program, and they would ideally warm transfer you to the Disabled Persons Protection Commission. If it's somebody in a nursing home, they're going to ask you if it's abuse or allegations of abuse by staff. If it is, they will transfer you to public health. Otherwise, what I've trained them to do is, I don't care where the person lives or who possibly might be involved, I want our agencies to begin to take that assessment and make those ultimate decisions.
Great. So I'm just trying to track the chat things that are coming in. I think we've answered most of them. I just want to clearly state that hoarding is considered something that people would report on.
Yes, correct.
Yes.
All right. So I want to open up, first of all, Lynn, did we get any questions emailed to you?
No.
Nope, okay. All right, does anybody want to unmute themselves and ask a question? And if so, I just ask that you state your name and where you're from. Okay. Well, I have some questions. Hey, oh, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Kathy, and I work at Northeast Legal Aid. I represent a lot of elders who are facing eviction. And, you know, obviously, we at Legal Aid have huge concerns about what will happen at the end of this eviction moratorium. And I know we're going to see an influx of referrals from elder services, protective services, about elders facing eviction, getting notices to quit. You know, and part of that ties into housing search. You know, does protective services have connections with organizations, or do they themselves assist elders in conducting housing searches?
So, Terry or Jonathan, do you want to just, I guess the question is, what happens when you have somebody facing an eviction and you get a protective service? Can you maybe walk us through what you guys would do?
We look at, you know, what's the reason for the eviction. We will look at other programs involved. You know, some of those eviction cases, they might be at a supportive housing site, and there's a supportive coordinator there that can help. And they do a lot of the back and forth between housing in terms of, can we have a meeting to determine what's going on? Why is there, you know, an eviction pending? What are the reasonings? Does the person need services? Is there something that can be done, obviously, with their lease agreement to have them say that they're going to accept certain services to prevent the eviction before it gets to that level? In terms of housing searches, we don't have a magic wand. We don't have, you know, a separate entity to allow us with housing for consumers that are facing eviction. We rely on a lot of the same, you know, resources that are out there for home care. Some of those cases we may send to options counseling to ask about housing and what they may have available. We do the best we can in terms of those searches. You know, we've tried to reach out and develop some contracts ourselves in terms of like respite care for short-term, you know, nursing facilities, if that's available. We look at the, you know, adult family care program, you know, for emergency placement in some aspects, if that's appropriate. So we do have some resources, but we don't have a leg up on resources per se. Jonathan, did you want to add anything?
No, I mean, each agency is required to have kind of an emergency housing contract. For many, you know, the first kind of angle would be a nursing home. You know, ideally, and I know Terry has kind of relationships with, you know, hotels and motels in her area where they might be able to put somebody up for a couple of nights or even up to 2 weeks. The problem is if protective services, you know, we can make you safe for 2 weeks, but there's nothing after that 2 weeks, then kind of where are we at? You know, we certainly understand that housing lists are very long in many communities, you know, but certainly if somebody's going through an eviction and they're a protective client and they're not violent, they, you know, it's not a drug related issue, you know, and it's something that home care can deal with or protective services can work with services, you know, really work to get them bumped to the top of the list. Or, I mean, having elders go to shelters is not an ideal situation. For most, many of them aren't able to go to shelters because of their medications or the safety issues. And so I think, you know, protective services, as Terry said before, doesn't have that magical, you know, kind of wand to make everything better. They're looking to everybody in the community and looking to collaborate with anybody and everybody they can to make the situation better. Because if you don't collaborate in your local communities, then it's not gonna, and I can tell you protective services won't be able to fix it. They need your support, they need your collaboration, is really what they need. And that means housing, that means legal, that means, you know, social service agencies, everybody, you know. And again, I know Old Colony has those good connections, but, you know, it's important to do that statewide. And I think that'll help with some of these evictions.
And I just want to remind folks, some people have been putting in the chat room, there's a state program that's not specific for older adults, but is it called the Tenancy Preservation Program, yes, which many of you are familiar with, and that PS is familiar with as well, that, you know, works that may have, you know, they don't have a magic wand either, but together between PS and the Tenancy mm-hmm. Preservation Program, hopefully, you know, is able to address some of these things. Sorry, go ahead, Terry.
I was just going to say they're a huge help in terms of collaborating with, as well as money management too. You know, if sometimes it's an issue with getting that rent paid on time, you know, referring to money management might be the assistance that we're able to provide.
So Jonathan, there's a question, why the reduction of the number of PS agencies statewide?
Going back many, many years, some has been consolidation, you know, like with the Boston agencies, they felt that one, having protective as opposed to three, there are three aging services access points, it was just easier. Some have, you know, over the years said, we just can't effectively run a program for whatever reason. And it's great they're standing up and we've, you know, handed it off to another entity or split it in some instances. I think the two most recently are the agencies. I can't speak for North Shore, but Chelsea Revere Winthrop, the executive director, retired, and he thought the best thing for moving forward was to merge his agency, or for that agency to cease to exist, and merge it with Mystic. So it wasn't a bad thing in any way. It was, you know, he was looking out for the best thing for the community as well as his staff. And with North Shore and Merrimack Valley, I think it's probably something similar where, you know, it gets difficult, you know, managing, you know, staffing-wise, administrative costs. And so as agencies think, you know, it would be better for their agency to merge with something. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of the administrative costs. You have one executive director. I mean, it helps in a whole lot of ways. So, you know, if it's an agency giving it up because they can't effectively run the program, I commend them for that. And for the other agencies, they're, again, they're looking for the programs to continue, but they can't in some way, so they're merging.
Right. So we have time for probably about one or two more questions if anyone wants to unmute themselves. I've been watching the chat room. Okay.
I've got.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
I got a tough question.
Wait, who is this?
Jerry Halberstadt, Stop Bullying Coalition. I'm familiar with a situation, and I'm not at liberty to say exactly where, but it's a person who's elderly, who has multiple disabilities, medical issues, which are quite severe. In part, it's been triggered by a severe reaction to some toxins, most likely due to a neighbor's cigarette smoking. And management knows it's a problem. They've admitted it to somebody, but they won't do anything about it. And I'm at my wit's end what to tell this woman so that she doesn't die. I mean, she's just losing it. She can't live in her apartment. She can't go into the apartment. Ideas? It's public health. It's a small public housing authority.
I mean, I certainly understand her concerns, but I would probably look to Emily from a housing management perspective to what can we do, what can't we do. I hate to say let's move somebody. That, you know, that doesn't necessarily make sense, nor would I want to do that on a regular basis. But because we don't, as Protective Services, control or oversee or license housing, I'd be looking to the housing, you know, connector in my office, which would be Emily. Not so dumping Jerry, on you, but.
No, that's fine. I just dumped everything on you for this call. So Jerry, if you want to send an email to Senior Housing COVID-19 with whatever you can share, you know, we are working with DHCD and Mass Housing and those folks, and we'll see if there's anything we can do to help. If you're willing to share which housing authority, we may be able to look into it. That's what I'm hearing from DHCD in the chat room. So
okay, I'll talk to the person involved and get permission to share as much as I can. And okay. Emily, thank you.
No problem. So we are almost at time. I wanted to just remind people, if Allison, can you put the 1-800 number and the website in the chat room, and we will send out materials after this, including some work. Terry, do you want to just say what Old Colony is up to for this month right now?
Yes, thank you. Old Colony is participating in World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, a virtual event on Facebook. So if you're able to, please visit our event page, OCES World Elder Abuse Virtual Event. And we're asking people to help raise awareness on elder abuse and how they're helping elders in their community by taking a picture of themselves, holding a sign as to what they're doing to assist, and then upload it to the event page. We're really trying to have people participate in the event. It's one of our first virtual events. We usually do a march against elder abuse in our communities, and we're unable to do that this year due to the COVID-19.
So Terry, I know you said that email, that website really quick. So we are gonna send that out to folks afterwards. That's fine. With all the materials, some people asked for the PowerPoint, all of that will go out. If you're on this call, you will get an email afterwards with the recording. The next call will be this a week from today. It will be talking about the role of philanthropy in relating to COVID-19. We'll be hearing from the Boston Foundation about how they're working with housing, and with the Tufts Health Plan Foundation, also how they're working with older adults. And just a heads up that there will be no call the week of the July 4th holiday. So I think that's July 2nd, and we'll resume after that. We will send this all out to you electronically, but just wanted to make sure I didn't forget to tell you. So I want to thank everybody, always thank Leading Age and the folks who help support this. Jonathan and Terry, thanks for all this information. Bottom line is, just call the number, right? Call the number, record it.
Call the number of your local agency, right? Yes.
Yep. And don't make the decision yourself. Don't worry about trying to solve it. Don't worry trying to figure it out. Call the number. So maybe you'll see after this call an increase in reports from all the folks on the phone who are holding back. Thank you to everybody. Have a good rest of your week and stay cool. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you.